Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Have you ever wondered why Canada is in debt? Have you ever wondered why the government forces Canadians to pay so many taxes? Have you ever wondered why the bankers from the largest private banks are becoming wealthier and the rest of us are not? Have you ever wondered why the gross national debt is over $800 billion? Or why we are spending $160 million a day on the interest of the national debt? That's $60 billion a year. Have you ever wondered who receives the $60 billion? What I have discovered is the banks and the government have colluded to financially enslave the people of Canada.
You may recognize that sweet, innocent voice speaking those hard assessments from a couple years ago. It was, of course, 12-year-old, at the time anyway, Victoria Grant of Canada, speaking at the Public Banking Conference in 2012 about a shocking realization she discovered when she was researching why Canada had such a large debt. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, and today we're going to delve a bit deeper into how the regime of funding government expenses from private parties undermines the very structure of our commonwealth and systemically moves public money into private hands. It's particularly timely now as our growing infrastructure needs go unmet at the national and local levels all over the country, and how the new administration intends to approach this problem. We'll talk with Ellen about that in just a moment. But we're also pleased to bring you a conversation with the author of a new book called Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism by Joyce Nelson, who describes how this situation has evolved and why it's the core issue underneath the deterioration of public wealth and our democratic institutions. Ellen has been writing about this subject, of course, in numerous ways over recent years in the process of our wanting to bring new American public banks into existence all over the country, the most direct means for the people to reclaim the money power for public policy, their communities, their cities, and our nation. It's a systemic problem that must be addressed. Ellen and I had a good conversation about how basic principles of banking could be applied for the public interest and transform the way we finance this impending large expense that's looming before us for the revival of our infrastructure.
Looking at Washington and how things are going relative to the infrastructure bank and financing and all of this stuff, you've got some new thoughts. What's going on?
Well, I'm actually here in Switzerland, and I've had a lot of time to listen to a lot of podcasts. There's a lot going on in Washington, D.C., and, of course, the liberal faction is outraged, as usual. But my bent is to give the new president the benefit of the doubt. And in any case, he's been called the wrecking ball and the great disruptor. So he's actually taking down old systems, and so it's our opportunity to get in some new ideas for how to build them back up. But one thing I wanted to comment, I listened to like everything Catherine Russell Fitz had said in the last 6 months or so. I know it looks bad that he's taken all these Goldman Sachs people onto his team, but she says that he needs them because they have the keys to the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is, or you know, the lever to it or whatever, that is how you manipulate markets. I mean, that's how all the stock market, the gold market, all the markets are manipulated, and it's through the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a pretty obscure thing that I won't go into. But the point is, it's sort of the team of rivals approach that you keep your friends close and your enemies closer, which is what Lincoln did and apparently Obama tried to do. It didn't necessarily work out so well for Obama. But the idea is that the opposition could bring down this administration by crashing the economy. but not if you have Goldman Sachs on your side, because they know how to prop it back up. So you want them with you and not against you. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, so is there any indication about any more specificity about Trump's infrastructure funding? You wrote a new piece about this, which I love the title of, which is Saving $1 Trillion on Infrastructure Without Deficits, Inflation, or Higher Taxes.
As far as I know, there hasn't been a new proposal from the Trump team since late last year, which would be the plan that was a public-private partnership, private equity funding plan. But that's not going to work for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's going to be very expensive. I mean, the argument is that the government doesn't have to pay for it, but we, the public, will have to pay for it. We have to pay for it in higher user fees. And a lot of those user fees people just can't afford, like water in Flint, Michigan. If you start raising those rates, people are not going to be able to have water, which is obviously should be considered a human right. And the things they're going to fund, well, I read that private equity makes on average 8 to 18%, so it's about 12% on average. So they're going to be looking for the projects that give a 12% return, and that's not going to be most of the infrastructure that needs doing, like the potholes and the, you know, repairing sewers, that kind of stuff, basic rebuilding of infrastructure. So we're not going to get the job done, and it's going to be very expensive. So I had written earlier about how the Bank of North Dakota is funding their infrastructure in the state of North Dakota at 2%. So 12% over 10 years is going to be another more than $1 trillion just in user fees or whatever profits going to private equity. So if you did it at 2% over 10 years, then your bill is only going to be $200 billion. So you're going to save $1 trillion right there because you're almost at $1.2 trillion with the private equity. But there are also other ways to do it. There was some mention by the Trump team of an infrastructure bank, even though originally Donald Trump was opposed to that idea. So an infrastructure bank is where it's a publicly owned bank, but it's different from the Bank of North Dakota. It's not a depository bank. It's a revolving fund. So they start out with a certain amount of capital that would come from Congress, I guess. Again, it's the private investors that are going to put up most of the money. And again, they're going to want a nice return. And it's a revolving fund. The money goes out, it gets paid back, and then it goes out again, and it gets paid back again. But if you have a depository bank like the Bank of North Dakota, you can actually create money on your books, which we now know that's what all banks do. Banks create deposits when they make loans. So you can leverage your money. So instead of a dollar goes out, a dollar comes back, you've got a dollar in and $10 can go out. In fact, some people say a lot more than that can go out. It depends on how you look at it. You can take your deposits, and theoretically, you're supposed to hold 10% back in reserve, and you can lend out 90% of your deposits. That's the old conventional model of how banking works. But in fact, as Richard Werner says, a UK professor, what they really do is they take all the deposits and they put it at the central bank and they say, okay, here's our reserves. So, for example, you get in $1 million in deposits, you put it in the Federal Reserve and say that's our reserve requirement. Then you can lend out $10 million. So this is money just created out of thin air. And when the checks go into another bank and you have to clear it through the Federal Reserve, obviously you don't have $10 million in your account and you have to come up with that money somehow. But what you do is you borrow from the money markets or the Fed funds or Federal Home Loan Banks. You borrow it like about 0.5%. And meanwhile, you're making whatever, 3%, 5%, 8%, 30%, depending on what kind of loan it is. So it's a very good deal for the banks. So that's where all our money comes from. And since it's going to be almost impossible to get Congress to vote to actually issue the money or to lift the debt ceiling, all those different ways that they could easily fund it just by issuing the money or have the Federal Reserve just issue it, since they're probably not going to do that in a divisive Congress, the simple thing to do is to set up a bank like the Bank of North Dakota, call it an infrastructure bank, take deposits, public deposits, and leverage your money into many times that sum in loans, and you own the bank, so you get the interest. You don't have to do bond issues, so you don't have to go through private bond banks, you know, which takes a lot of fees as well. So that was my proposal.
Well, that was a very, very comprehensive proposal, and you covered all the bases. And you'd think that it's so obvious that municipalities and cities would say, well, let's see, I have a choice. I can either borrow the money I need or I can create it. You'd think that would be a fairly easy sort of a choice to make.
Yeah, well, the problem and what, you know, we keep hammering away is that they don't get it. They don't understand that banks create the money, and therefore they think they're going to be lending their revenues, and then they say, we can't afford to lend our revenues, we need them for our budget. So that's what I keep hammering away at, is how it really works, and if we can't beat them, we can join them and turn it to good public use.
There is a kind of a lot of a pushback by the established political and banking interests. Some states have said, well, we looked at that a couple of years ago, and we didn't want to compete with our banks, and it was going to be too, and we didn't want to run a bank, you know, didn't want the Treasury running a bank. And so there's a lot of misinformation, but also certainly a lot of resistance to disturbing the status quo with a new idea.
Right. I saw somewhere bureaucracies exist to preserve the status quo. I mean, they're against change. You've got all these rules that keep you from doing anything new and creative. So that is the challenge, is to getting past the rules. And here we have an administration that wants to get rid of the rules. I mean, that freaks everybody out because you might get rid of the good rules as well. It is a chance to get in there with something different.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure how much power is in the hands of just this one individual and that team. I think there are much bigger influences that are going on, too.
Agreed, yeah.
And because the people around the country are struggling, almost 50% of the people can't come up with an extra $400 a month, and one out of five of our kids are food insecure. I mean, that's crazy. So in the last couple of weeks, you've seen people come to the streets, which is very unusual in America and probably long overdue, but it has gotten to a point now where there's very little promise that things are going to change and pretty much certainty that nothing's going to happen from Washington or from certainly, you know, Wall Street's not going to do Main Street any favors. And so we're at an interesting point here where the period for change, the opportunity for change, and Trump's being a changer kind of guy, your suggestion has some interest. But I think the change is going to have to come from the people.
Right. Well, and that's another argument for state-owned banks, city-owned banks, because you can't count on the central government. So you need to do it locally. And they can do it. It's the same deal. States don't have the power to issue money directly, literally, because the Constitution says they can't do it. It's a power they delegated, or the colonies delegated, to the federal government when they signed on to the Union. But they can own a bank, which is where far more of our money comes from than from the central government. Plus, there's this movement to divest from the big Wall Street banks. For example, Seattle and Davis just pulled out of Wells Fargo. So where are they going to put their money? I mean, even if they shifted into another Wall Street bank, they've all been caught in corruption of one sort or another, or outright criminal fraud. So you need to set up your own bank.
That's right. There are not many choices at the moment, but there's so many opportunities once that structure gets formed for a state. And the idea of keeping the money in the state or the city or the county or whatever is such a dramatic difference than sending it to New York. Once you put that tax money into Wells' hands or one of the big banks, it's gone, and it's a higher risk. The point is that it's not working locally.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very exciting prospect.
We're in dangerous times, scary times, but also exciting and promising times.
Well, you've increased my excitement about what's going to happen next.
Okay.
We'll see what's going to happen next, Ellen. Thanks very much for that.
My mother actually passed away recently in 97, but I think what kept her going, she always said, well, I just want to see how it's all going to turn out. She likes to watch the news. Okay, well, it's been great talking to you.
Good talking to you, too, and have a safe trip back.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
So we've just talked with Ellen about how the franchise of creating money for public purposes by public entities, like cities, counties, and states, when they operate or create their own public banks, can dramatically change the landscape of public well-being, safety, and prosperity, and how that capability has been kept or hidden from public officials who've never even considered it, and how it has been sandbagged by banking and political interests who don't want that fiefdom of profiteering and power to slip from their grasp into meddling public hands. This is the underlying reality of why the public banking movement is so important to our future prosperity. And there's some urgency in creating this awareness because the window of opportunity is closing on the public's influence over policy as the wealth that wields political power continues to get egregiously lopsided in favor of the wealthiest individuals. We spoke with Joyce Nelson, the author of a new book called Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism, and she tells a most interesting and timely tale of how our neighbors to the north in Canada are addressing their version of a bankster takeover of their sovereign democratic rights to control their own money and to build a debt-free future. You'll recall from the start of this program that young Victoria Grant laid out that problem very clearly, and that there is, in fact, an evident conspiracy to control and indebt the people of Canada and the world by the global banking interests. These interests have propelled Canada into a trillion-dollar-plus debt zone after they had been debt-free for decades. This is the same situation that Ellen was talking about, where the big financial interests are allowed to continue their exploitation of nations and markets above and beyond the control of governments themselves. In fact, often in collaboration with the governments who do the bidding of the wealthy political special interests. Joyce Nelson's book details how this has unfolded in Canada and the relevance of it for us in the United States, where the same group is twisting policy decisions at all levels of our government toward reliance on borrowing privately at enormous expense when we could otherwise generate our own money for free. I asked Joyce, who has been writing on environmental and other issues for 40 years, how she got involved with this topic, which has acquired substantial public attention in Canada.
In January of last year, we started talking about what's called the Bank of Canada lawsuit. This is a lawsuit that the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform has launched to get Canada to go back to the Bank of Canada's mandate, which is to loan interest-free money to governments. So I did a piece on this issue, and it went viral, you know, 150,000 people. So that, in Canada, that's viral. So we realized, oh, that's really interesting. Then I did another piece for the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform for their newsletter, updating and looking at the players now involved. The Trudeau government is trying to bypass the lawsuit and put in another bank. The Canada Infrastructure Bank.
Yep.
So I did a look at who are the financial players behind this, and that too got a lot of attention. And as a result, I decided there's a book here. That book came out in November. It's already into its second printing. My background is more in environmental issues, but this is really, I mean, money is behind everything, right?
Yes. So yes.
Once you figure out who is calling the shots, in economic terms, you can actually make changes and do something. So the whole issue of public banking is really now up in Canada. It's really, really interesting. I just read this really fascinating piece this morning in The Nation online.
Yeah.
It's on Ecuador. Your listeners might want to read it. It's about Ecuador. Rafael Carrera is a PhD in economics, so he's, you know, he knows a lot. And what he did over the last 10 years is fascinating. He basically did what Canada did. He used the central bank for lending to governments and controlling capital flight. And as a result, Ecuador has been quite successful over the last 10 years, financially and economically successful. As I was reading it, I thought, that's exactly what we're trying to get the Bank of Canada here in Canada to go back to. From 1938 to 1974, you know, it was lending. Bank of Canada was lending to provincial and federal governments, basically interest-free, and funding infrastructure. It funded Canada's participation in World War II, and then massive infrastructure in the post-war years, you know, the whole Trans-Canada Highway system, the ports, airports, the St. Lawrence Seaway, too,
and
exactly.
And the education and health systems.
Education and pensions and health care. And, you know, it worked very well. There was no inflation, and there was no borrowing from private lenders.
Uh-huh.
So the sovereign debt, as it's called, stayed very low, and it did not vary for 35 years. So my book is looking at why did they go off that? What were the factors involved that the government of Pierre Trudeau dropped that system and went to the neoliberal system? What was going on there?
What was going on there, Joyce?
Well, the more I learn, the more fascinating I'm finding it. But what was going on there was the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS in Basel, basically said, if you want to join the BIS, you're gonna have to stop doing what you're doing, Canada. So the governor, the Bank of Canada governor, then insisted that Bank of Canada stop loaning and instead start borrowing. But, of course, other things going on, too. That was 1973-74. That was the same era in which the U.S. financial sector stopped controls about capital and could then start going across border with financial lending. It was also the time when the big offshore tax haven system took off. So you've got some, you know, big changes going underway in 1973-74. The part I focus on more so is, because I'm a fan of John Perkins, I'm looking at, you know, his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, opened up for everybody's view. He made people aware of the fact that a whole system had been set up to basically force the third world into these huge infrastructure loans that they couldn't afford, and basically indebted them for infrastructure. The money went directly to the big construction firms like Bechtel and, you know, Halliburton and Brown and Root and Shaw and all those big infrastructure companies, and the third world got increasingly indebted. So that was going on, that there's this whole subtext. And it's called neoliberal economics is basically what it is, which we've been captured by and stuck in
right.
for 40 years.
Yeah, and of course set the stage for the sort of dystopic outcomes that we've seen in countries that have been forced into austerity through the insistence of the bankers.
It's a very clever package, isn't it? You know, first you indebt countries, and then you force them to give away their infrastructure.
And you see it not just in nations, but also in cities. In
yep.
Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, and Ferguson, Missouri. I mean, this is the same pattern.
One of the things I've been noticing is there's been a lot of questioning in the U.S. about, well, Trump's going to put in an infrastructure bank, and he wants to fund infrastructure. How is he going to fund it? In the book, I'm suggesting how he's going to fund it. And here's what I can tell you. There have been big private investment firms. For almost a decade, they have been amassing huge dedicated funds for buying up and investing in infrastructure. And I'm talking about Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Global Infrastructure Partners. That's a joint venture between Credit Suisse Group and General Electric. The Carlyle Group, Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts & Company. You've probably heard of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Canadian firms like Brookfield Asset Management, Borealis Infrastructure, the pension funds. So what they're hoping is that all this needed infrastructure, some of it will be through public-private partnerships, and my book certainly gives lots of information and ammunition that your readers and listeners can use if they're trying to understand and go after public-private partnerships. But even more crucial, I think what they're going to do is what they've been trying to do in Canada, in Australia, in Denmark, and it's called asset recycling. And because I and others have written about asset recycling, these big financial players are now scrambling around to find a different term. But essentially what it does is it convinces governments to sell off a hospital to pay for a road.
Mm-hmm.
Asset recycling is what it's been called. And what they're looking at in the U.S. What they want, what the privateers want to get their hands on, is federal assets like the U.S. Postal Service, Amtrak, the air traffic control system, water utilities, federal electricity infrastructure, interstate highways, bridges, seaports, airports, even federal lands, even national parks. So they want these assets because you get a steady toll from them. They want to have a toll gate economy, and they're going to be the landlords. So that's my warning to your listeners, like, hold on to your assets. Yes, you're mentioning it's happening too in the cities, but they're planning big time.
Yeah, and it's all over the world too, of course, in Greece and Cyprus and Brazil and Puerto Rico and all over the place, the same game is being played.
Same game.
Yeah, and you call it the new feudalism, and it most certainly is that, but your book title is Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism. Do you have steps for that, or is just information the first step?
Information is always the first step. Consciousness is always the first step.
Yeah.
You know, once you know what's going on, once you see what's going on, you pretty much can't forget it or ignore it.
Yeah.
So consciousness information is the first step. But I'm also looking at many of the things your group is interested in, you know, basic public banking information. I don't think many people, certainly not in Canada, had heard of the Bank of North Dakota, and I don't think many people in America had heard about the Bank of Canada and how it funded infrastructure from 1938 to 1974 without getting into debt.
Yeah.
So those kinds of solutions, and also postal banking, those kinds of solutions are gaining more and more appeal as people understand how they're being ripped off.
And they sell the national debt as if it's the greatest sin that we have to deal with, as a way of making us think that we are not sovereign and that we can't create our own money. And then, of course, as a way for them to keep us all on the treadmill of paying them, the rentier society, the feudalist society. It's exactly what that is, isn't it? You know, we only rent here. We're only here if we can pay our way. The rest of us are living on the street. And, of course, those numbers are growing significantly. The Comer case is particularly interesting because where does the case stand now? Do they have one more shot to go to the Supreme Court, or have they been dismissed?
I went to the hearing in December where it was an appeal, and they lost the appeal. And so steps have now been taken to take the case to the Supreme Court of Canada. In other words, the case has not even been heard yet. It's just trying to get the case to be heard. That's the next step. But with this Canada-Europe Trade Agreement, CETA, C-E-T-A, there's a provision in CETA that would disallow anything like the Bank of Canada lending. So everything's very much in play right now. We don't know yet if CETA is given provisional approval, which it may well be within the next few weeks, then that would kill the lawsuit. At the same time, the Comer people, Rocco Galati and the Comer people and Paul Hellyer, have advanced a lawsuit against CETA.
Good.
Precisely the reasons I just gave. They don't want CETA to kill their other lawsuit, right?
Right.
But the government did something really sneaky. Because their lawsuit against CETA was based on the 1,600-page trade deal, the government cut the trade deal by several pages and called it a new deal. For some reason, that undercuts their CETA lawsuit. So they have to refile.
Yeah.
But they can't refile until it's actually approved. Okay. So dirty tricks at play. These Comer folks are so determined and so admirable.
You know, we're pulling for you guys up there. We want to get that Bank of Canada back in action.
Oh, thank you. I'm so pleased to talk to you, Walt.
Thank you very much, Joyce.
That's Joyce Nelson, author of the new book, Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism. Available from Watershed Sentinel Books at watershedsentinel.ca. We'll close this segment of the program with a lesson. perfectly applicable to the United States, from our young Canadian friend Victoria Grant, who opened this program. Here is the wisdom of a child, speaking truth to power. And that power is us.
What I find interesting is even Jesus, in Matthew 21, drove out the money changers in the temple because they were manipulating the currency to steal money from the people. The private banks are just like the money changers in Matthew 21. They are defrauding and robbing the people of Canada, thus their freedom, and they need to be stopped. How should the banking system work? In an infamous interview, Mr. McGeer asked Mr. Towers, "Can you tell me why a government with power to create money should give that power away to a private monopoly and then borrow that which Parliament can create itself back at interest to the point of national bankruptcy?" Mr. Towers replied, "If Parliament wants to change the form of operating the banking system, then certainly that is within the powers of Parliament." In other words, if the Canadian government needs money, they can borrow it directly from the Bank of Canada. The people would then pay fair taxes to repay the Bank of Canada. This tax money would in turn get injected back into our economic infrastructure, and the debt would be wiped out. Canadians would again prosper with real money as a foundation of our economic structure and not debt money. Regarding the debt money owed to the private banks, such as the Royal Bank, we would simply have the Bank of Canada print the money owing, hand it over to the private banks, and then clear the debt with the Bank of Canada. And yes, we have the power and lawful right to do so. In conclusion, it has become painfully obvious, even for me, a 12-year-old Canadian, that we are being defrauded and robbed by the banking system and a complicit government. What will we do to stop this crime? What will we do to ensure that the next generation will live free and clear of the debt-based economy that enslaves them to the banks? Margaret Mead said the following, and I hope that all of you remember this. "Never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." Thank you.
We're going to stay in Canada for our next discussion as we go to Edmonton, Alberta, to talk about the economics of happiness. A look at how economics factors into our sense of well-being and how the systems we use now could be altered to replace that stressful pursuit of money. You know what they say? Money won't bring you happiness. And there's clear economic evidence that that's true. I spoke with our colleague Mark Anielski, economist and international consultant, about his award-winning book called The Economics of Happiness.
When I wrote the book, the original title was just Genuine Wealth, which is a model I've developed over the years. You know, I've learned that, first of all, we don't have a proper balance sheet for nations or municipalities that you'd expect of any other kind of corporate accounting. And the word wealth comes from the Old English, means the conditions of well-being. And so I found that quite fascinating. If that's really the old definition, then my argument was that we could legitimately measure the condition of well-being of, let's say, five capital asset classes: human, social, built, natural capital, and financial capital or economic capital. But of course, you know, the word happiness sold, and in 2007, it seemed like I hit this perfect wave of interest in happiness of all kinds, from positive psychology to economists, and then Bhutan's gross national happiness, sort of Bhutan leading the way to this new paradigm. So it was perfect timing for me. I quibble about the word happiness. For me, Aristotle said happiness in the Greek means well-being of your spirit. Of course, some of us would say happiness is a fleeting kind of thing, but it turns out that well-being is a more solid theoretical construct coming now out of positive psychology, saying if we can measure something, then it has a theoretical foundation. And that's just emerging now, to say there's a well-being science emerging. So what are the kind of drivers, determinants of well-being? And then follows that, could we develop an economy that is oriented towards improving or optimizing well-being based on these assets?
But that is such a different pursuit, it would seem, at least in the Western mind. You know, you're going at, one is going after money and the other is going after pleasure, as it were. Is there a mindset of distinction between those two that we can actually get past?
I think so. I mean, that, of course, our mindset in the certainly Western economies has been growth focused on GDP, and that's been around certainly since World War II, when it was important to get the economy growing and pay for the war effort, and that's where GDP and the system of national accounts emerges out of that era. But I would say that, you know, with countries like Bhutan and that sort of saying, look, it's not a certain point when you have enough money suggests that there's a kind of tapering off of people's needs for more material things. And you could argue that the economy, too, kind of reaches a sort of a steady state, perhaps, or I call it a maintenance level of economy, where more growth isn't actually necessarily improving happiness overall. I mean, I'm not saying that we should definitely deal with income inequality, and inequality is rising, and we know from history it destroys civilizations. And one of my big pieces in this whole question of, well, why is growth necessary? Why do we always hear more growth, even yesterday we heard with Prime Minister Trudeau meeting President Trump saying, we have to keep this thing going for the middle class. And my argument is, part of the reason is, and you know this too from the Public Banking Institute, is that, you know, the growth push is partly due to the fact that we have a debt-based money system, which requires constant GDP to simply to service the growing mountain of debt and the interest burden on that debt. So it becomes an impossible situation. As Herman Daly once said, it's like cancer. You can't stop this thing, and you can't, you know, how are we going to resolve this conundrum where the growth imperative is driven by a debt-based money system that nobody seems to actually understand or address?
And how do we get out of that? I mean, if you were taught we have to buy things and people are obliged and focused on that, do they have to make some sort of a shift? Again, going back to this mental idea of making a mental transition into some new way of relating to themselves as being disconnected from their money and more connected with the different values?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I could speak for my own family and our own lifestyle. Like, to, as a business person, coming to that place where, okay, you know, how much, once the mortgage is gone, and the mortgage in French means a death pledge, which I love. It's like, once we've sort of conquered that, how much money do you need to maintain the household? And so of course, we're antithetical to the growth economy because we don't consume as much. We don't need as much income. I don't have to work as hard. Of course, I can choose to work harder, but the choice then is mine, and I'm free from the pressures of so many Canadian American households face with the daunting pressures of debt. And so, you know, this is an individual choice. You know, I'm not saying everyone should live frugally or live like we do, but there's a certain freedom that comes when those debts are gone, and you actually have more discretionary time now to dedicate to others or to the community or to your children. And those are choices that my wife and I made, and I've made as a business person. So if you think about that for the whole economy, and I've estimated now that the cost of interest on the total amount of debt in the United States, which the total debt now is around $65 trillion, that includes all debt, is about, it's equivalent of about 52 cents on every dollar of household income the average American household will earn. So that is just outrageous that, you know, we'll spend, that's like saying you'll spend half your life working just to pay the interest on everybody's debt, when that was actually not necessary if you study, you know, public banking and the alternatives. And so I think this is a compelling argument. I think there's a practical solution to this. Politically, it's difficult, as you know. This is charged with emotion and politics, and so. But we're trying. I'm trying with others to create a new financial architecture that says we can bank without charging interest. We can create investment funds that are investing in local community assets, not money fleeing into Wall Street and phantom wealth, but building real community wealth. And I think This is not even fancy. It's not magical. It's just working within the current scope of accounting and even investment protocols. Just saying, you know, we can do this without charging the interest. We can recover our operating costs, but still, I think, keep the money local, become each other's bankers, and that's what I'm working on.
Yeah. So the charging of interest is really the key that creates the unsustainable or really unquenchable need for growth. But it's also the driver that keeps the money power in power, in place.
Mm-hmm. Is that, mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. Simply the acceptance. I mean, in the old days, it was called usury. The old philosophers, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, even the Christian church a long time ago said that, you know, charging money on money, you know, earning money on money and then having banks create the money out of thin air is like anathema. Almost like a sin against the truth, which the truth is abundance. And so we have this strange system where we've accepted this approach to creating money when money is just a social construct. It's something we create out of our imagination. And yet, how many people understand that 98% of the money comes when banks create, you know, issue loans and then attach interest to it? If you say all of that is unnecessary, that's what the public bank argument is, what do we do with this? Because this is the big challenge now. Like, we can't blow up the matrix, and, you know, you can't even let air out of this inflating balloon in the way that achieves a less intensive lifestyle. If I take 52 cents out of the equation of the household, then your work week goes to 20 hours a week. Right. And not quickly, but that's what's potentially available to us.
I think some people would be afraid of being bored by not having enough.
Well, this is my argument. It's like, I'm not sure we're actually mature enough to take responsibility for a 20-hour work week.
Yeah. Well, what role then would banks play in that scenario?
I think banks would still provide the financial services they do now. Actually, I always thought banks created loans against assets. Well, most banks, at least in Canada, actually don't really care about the value of the asset. They care about, do you have a job? Will you service the loan monthly? And for them, that's how they manage risk. And so what I'm saying is the new bank or the banks such as credit unions or public banks, in the case here in Alberta, we have the Alberta Treasury Branch, which is the biggest public bank in North America. The banks could still play that financial services role by, you know, verifying assets, by checking out our business plans as business people, making sure that we're not throwing good money after bad ideas, you know, leveraging the utility of real assets. We all need homes. We all need an education. Some of us need post-secondary degrees. And all of these things the banks can still play a role in, but they can do so, and I've shown this analytically, they can do so without charging interest. Why? Because banks, like any other business, simply needs to recover its operating costs. And let's say it's 2% of the value of the loan portfolio, which is the case in the case of Alberta Treasury Branch. And they have to manage risk. So, yes, there will be loan losses. People will go bankrupt. And so you got to manage the risk as well. But once you cover both operating and risk, I think it's viable to run these institutions very efficiently. And if the bank is now in a sense it becomes a kind of a public utility, and it would have to operate in concert with a central public bank. The Federal Reserve is not a public bank. The Bank of Canada is a quasi-public bank. So we'd want to see those relationships from the macro level to the local level.
Well, it certainly is a different, a desired model, and something that I hope we get to see in our lifetimes, because it requires pulling off the cold, dead hands of the power structure off of the levers of our prospect. In Bhutan, you talked about their health quotient or their what kind
gross
of
special happiness. Bhutan has what they call the Gross National Happiness Index. And it really, actually was designed, the survey tool was designed by a Canadian epidemiologist. And epidemiologists, of course, study, you know, the sort of health of systems, of complex systems. And so what that entails is a household survey that takes about 8 hours to complete, because a lot of people in Bhutan don't have computers. So, you know, it basically surveys the self-rated well-being conditions of people of Bhutan. And that then becomes an alternative index to GDP. And I'm working on similar work here in Canada and at the community level, saying we will measure the objective conditions of well-being, those five asset classes I spoke about, and then we'll do a subjective well-being survey of community members, and they'll tell us everything about even the quality of their sleep and their degree of hope for the future, their levels of personal life satisfaction, diet, mental well-being, right, and financial stress. So the results are fascinating because we get a real kind of doctor, like a full diagnostic, full checkup on the well-being of the community, both objectively with statistics from conventional statistics, and then the perceptions of people. So we can marry the perceptional metrics with the objective metrics and come up with a well-being state of well-being report that then guides local decision making, budgeting, planning, and other organizations can use it, including, you know, all kinds of organizations, United Way or whoever, to then make better decisions. And my argument is, if you then take that information and you say, well, that also could guide banking, you know, and insurance and other kind of financial service industries, I think you get a really exciting economy.
That would be a dramatic shift as a driver for public policy.
Mm-hmm.
To have a whole new set of metrics about how, you know, what we're going to be doing with our money. A very, very interesting approach. And again, it seems to be a very appropriate sort of a transitional moment, as you indicated before, about how the number of hours that are really required to generate a sustainable life economic, financially here are reducing, in some cases disappearing, because people don't have a place in the economies anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the metric that we saw where once people make $72,000 a year in America, mm-hmm. they pretty mm-hmm. much hit the threshold of happiness, of that potential happiness. And that's not a lot of money for in the scheme of things, but it
no,
is
it's
at
not.
Least...
And think about it, actually, it could be $35,000 without the burden of interest. So,
$70,000
is not, it's within reach of a lot of people. And I think that's what's, you know, there's a marginal increment in happiness beyond that threshold. And I think all that says is at some point in your life, the mortgage is done, right? Your kids are grown up. And what is there? You know, life becomes maintenance. Yeah, you could travel more. You could buy a bigger house or nicer stuff. But you could actually relax at that level. You know, that's an individual choice. But, yeah, we could model the economy just on, you know, how many people are close within that bandwidth of 50 to 75,000, right? And how many are below that? How many do we have to lift out of poverty? How can we do that? You know, should people be entitled to making multiple millions? I don't know. That's a societal debate. You know, inequity is an issue, but I don't have a magic bullet for that. But, you know, at the very least, as an economist, I say, you know, how is every city doing with respect to that $70,000 threshold as a household, right?
And, of course, the axiom holds true of the best things in life are free.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Axioms roll off, we kind of laugh about them, and it's like, but it's true, you know. Relationships are the fundamental basis of happiness, you know. Trust, these things, you know, they're meaningful, they're quantifiable, they're... You can destroy trust in an instant, or you can build it over a lifetime. And
when you talk about trust being quantifiable, I mean, trust and relationship are really the two primary parts of money itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we trust each other, and it's really about, you know, an engagement with each other's energies and commitments and intentions. And that then becomes some sort of a capital base upon which we extend credit. Do they not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's what we're arguing here is that trust, you know, I've worked with companies and saying, can you monetize trust on your balance sheet? You know, accountants would call it goodwill. And I'm saying, you know what? The modern corporation, a lot of their financial health is based on relationships and trust with clients. And so can those things be monetized? I think so. Accountants would say, oh, goodwill is only 10% of your balance sheet. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's got to be worth more. Ask Warren Buffett. He looks at Coca-Cola. Look at their balance sheet. You know, 30% are intangibles. So I think, yeah, money is a weird thing. It's, you know, my vision is, what if we were each other's bankers? What if we were able to transact, you know, and we can get into the whole blockchain and Bitcoin and all that and all those digital currency, those new fintech opportunities. But imagine if each of us were autonomous and we already are wealthy in the sense of we have gifts, we have skills, but we're sort of born into this matrix where we're, well, actually the only solution to finance our future is to go to the bank and get, you know, there's no way we can come up with $250,000. And so I think that's the interesting architectural piece of this is how can we use these new emerging technologies like blockchain to actually create, and the word in that world is sort of trust-free contract. So every time we enter a relationship, we're entering a contract of trust, right? And then could we, in a sense, create our own money against our asset? You know, let's say every person born, take that $70,000, actually I'd reduce it to $35,000 because there'd be no more interest in my model. What would you be worth as an asset if you lived to 80 years of age, right? And could you design a system where everyone is insured a living wage? It's a guarantee. No one will ever go hungry. And could you design a system where you achieve that goal for society? And I'd say, Yeah,
it would seem so. And, you know, of course, the contrast to the contrary to the economics of happiness, the economics of unhappiness is what we are living with. Because of that huge 50% overload of obligation of debt, we are so constrained and unhappy. And you look at the unhappiness in the society, in part driven by the absence, the deprivation of some of these basic things. It would seem to be a fairly simple sort of a step to get beyond that if we could eliminate some of these keys. But unfortunately, those keys belong to the people who have all the power, or at least most of the power at this point.
Well, and I think that's a bit of a, I've been in the pool for a long time and debating, you know, with martyr reformists. And my approach now is not to think that, oh, there's, you know, 50 guys that control the world. And that may be true. I mean, yes, the banks, the investment banks and that, they have the corporate license to operate, and they're very happy with that system. And we know over history that we've had these tussles before, going back to the Revolution and Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Jackson. And, you know, so my study of U.S. history says, we've been having this debate for a long time. And so the question is, you know, who should have the power to create money? And should that be a public utility? Should it be a constitutional right? These are big issues. And the sad thing is they're not being debated in a way that they might have been during even the times of Benjamin Franklin. So, but my approach now is let's at the very least work within the existing system. We do have credit union options. We have public bank options. We have a new investment fund architecture I'm trying to develop, and we propose it to the city of Cincinnati that based on what I'm talking about is that, and we can, I think we can do that without upsetting the apple cart. We will, in this ecosystem, we're just, hopefully that the reason we're so compelling is because we're more competitive cost-wise, and we deliver a real benefit, especially to low-income households. I mean, zero-interest mortgages, you know, those are things that are actually possible and they're economically viable. So, you know, I feel like we have a responsibility to do that, especially to those who are worse off. And so we're not attacking anyone. We're just saying, look, we're just working within the realm of the existing system and with good accounting protocols.
And of course, you touched on a really sensitive matter of affordable housing, and as I heard out west recently, just attainable housing is a concern. Well, where do I get to live these days? You know, rents and houses are out of the question in some of these markets, not only from a lack of supply, but of course the lack of availability because of the market valuations, the commodification of essential services like a home.
right. Yeah. I could tell you a little bit about that. So one of my most exciting projects right now is working with Habitat for Humanity, and Jimmy Carter's coming here in July with Rosalind to help build 75 homes in the Edmonton area where I live. So it's pretty exciting. Why I love Habitat is because it was designed not by Millard Fuller and his wife, not to necessarily provide housing per se, but actually freedom from the burden of interest. And so he came at it from a very kind of Christian perspective, literally to live the gospel, you know, like how do we live without debt? And so the Habitat model is remarkable, and I've studied it forensically to say they're delivering zero interest mortgages. The mortgages are based on 25% of income. And what you have essentially is exactly what I've been envisioning for Cincinnati, which is the potential for a self-sustaining fund, a trust that perpetuates the development of homes and zero interest mortgages for low-income households. And what happens is a lot of these tenants, they don't stay very, they may stay 5 years, because what they're doing is they're graduating out of poverty into a $50,000, $60,000 income, which to that point, they want to be out of that Habitat home, because now they're able to actually walk away with equity in their pocket, which is, refunding all of those mortgage payments back to them. So it's quite a remarkable model, and it's something I'm so keen about. And the model works. It doesn't matter whether it's Cincinnati or the Rust Belt, where you have, degraded assets, boarded up heritage homes that are actually now, they're assets that can be restored, and we can put a lot of low-income households into those homes. So that's why I'm excited.
Well, it's exciting to me, too. You are a trailblazing one of the new models that will play an important role or a significant role in helping to develop the new local-based economies, that utility that brings us together and establishes community through the new mechanisms of economic models like you're describing.
Yeah. Exactly. The only caveat, none of this is going to be easy. I mean, we all have a weird relationship with money, and when we raise it amongst ourselves, the discussion, it's a very tricky area to navigate. And so I'm under no illusion that any of this will be easy, because right now, in a way, we're strangely comfortable with this monopoly over money creation that banks have, right? Because that's all we're accustomed to. So when we're now talking about we become each other's bankers, wow, that's going to be a challenge. So.
Yeah, that's an evolutionary step, and I think that's kind of at that moment, the failure of the old of the old matrix. And we can welcome, embrace, and think through the new possibilities. Mark, thank you so much for spending this time with us and talking about the economics of happiness.
Thanks, Walt.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
That's Mark Anielski, author and international economist, discussing his book, The Economics of Happiness. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.